You don't build cool ideas. You build really cool ideas that also meet direct market needs or solve problems that your customers didn't know existed.
Are we recording?
Oh my God. Better Product, the only show that takes a behind-the-scenes look into how digital products are created,
the businesses built around them, and how you too can innovate better product. I'm Christian.
I'm Anna.
Welcome to today's show.
When is the right time to build a product? And who should lead the charge? Is it sales-led, product-led? What features should you build, and when should you build those features?
When have you asked too many hypothetical product questions?
Never?
No. Yeah, I guess that's true. And I think we'll probably answer a lot of those questions today. But the truth is, there's really a lot of moving parts when it comes to launching new products.
Definitely. You have to be able to set a roadmap.
Secure leadership buy-in for that roadmap.
But still be agile and aware of what your competitors are doing.
Yeah, it's a lot. In today's episode, we're going to learn more about that as we talk with Jeremy Leventhal, the Chief Product Officer at Springbuck.
Springbuck is a health analytics software company. Jeremy has over 15 years of leadership experience building products and product teams. When he joined Springbuck in 2016, he was the company's first person to oversee product.
My first order of business was a little bit more sales and business oriented. So it was not necessarily the product. I thought the product, I loved the look and feel of it. I thought it was a great base for what we needed to do. But the main thing was, what were our outstanding customer commitments? And just went through that list and we started knocking them out. And we knocked them out over probably about 2.5 months, which got us to a really good base foundation of, okay, now that we don't owe anybody anything, essentially, we've cleared our list, what is the next thing to focus on?
Once Jeremy got his knockout list done, he was able to step back and truly assess what was next.
I thought we were in a pretty good spot from just a pure product foundation, but from a business foundation, making sure that the features that we said we were going to do, whether it was a brand new feature or whether it was an addition, just an enhancement to an existing one, making sure that we built those in the right way to keep our current client base where it was, and then think about what does expansion look like.
To hear his perspective on what it takes to launch a new product was truly insightful.
A note to listeners, their new product is actually called Insights, so please forgive Christian for that terrible joke. Anyway, he shares with us that when they launched their newest product, Insights, it was their most successful launch they had in company history.
When it comes to software, you can keep mining for new things to create endlessly. One thing Jeremy has been able to do really well is focus. He understands the importance of working alongside the sales team while staying connected to the end user, which is the customer. Take a listen.
I also like to be really strong on the business side. I mean, I think a great product manager has a really strong business head on his or her shoulders. And you know, not only is sales building their own pipeline, product should be building their own estimation of a pipeline from what sales is doing and judging where that goes. But so to that point, I think I worked directly with the CEOs and COOs of a couple of these big companies where we made promises to. And I said, if we do X, Y, and Z and put it in an email, put it in a kind of contractual bind, if we do these things, are we on good footing? And getting sign off on kind of the initial project plan, if you will. And then once you deliver, saying, this is how we delivered, and then getting sign off that we delivered. So being really, really rigid and saying, this is, you know, again, that's not agile software development. It's like a project plan of how we're going to execute to get to a house. I think any good product shop should not just say, hey, we're only agile. You should say, we have a variety of tools in our toolbox. Some of these are waterfall kind of projects. A lot of it is just iterative, I call it, not just agile, just iterative development. And other things are just bursts of sprints of energy on things. I think you use those tools as you see fit, as long as you adhere to a philosophy. If that's an agile philosophy in general, that's fine.
So how do you manage, I would say that's potentially a controversial statement, right? The idea that you might be agile and maybe you do waterfall here, or you do these bursts. How do you manage all those tools and manage all those different processes?
So I think if you look at the pie chart breakdown of the work that we do, 90%+ is iterative, agile philosophy, agile breakdown, and no one does agile the same. So in general, we think about how do we roll out that minimum viable, minimum lovable product? How do we roll out the alpha, I'll even call it, forget about the MVP, like how we roll out something we can get in customers' hands in production that they can play with and give us feedback. And we'll talk about some examples more later, but how do we get to that point as fast as possible and then do a variety of tests, these small experiments, and then work your way up to this product that you feel like you can put a GA stamp on.
GA being?
Generally available for everybody.
I think a lot of times when you're starting up a product, at least we're advising people to really keep it simple and focus on one audience. Because if you try to do more than one, you're going to set yourself up for a lot of challenges. You almost have double the effort on everything, double the design effort, double engineering effort, double sales effort. But here you are kind of the exception to that rule. So I'm curious how, from a product perspective, you manage that. You mentioned through the design of having different interfaces. So how do you maintain that product? This is 2016, and now, you know, over 2 years later, you're seemingly successful. How have you sort of managed those multiple threads and balanced all the different needs of different users in the product?
I think the biggest thing we looked for was, okay, if this is a job to be done, that we look at whose job to be done is it, does it cross over personas? So we kind of score this sort of stuff to the best of our ability, right? Because you're not going to nail every group's special interest. But there's a lot of overlap when you actually do look at it, because everyone's trying to operate off that same scorecard.
You talked about when initially you guys were looking to see how you're serving each of your personas, like how many features they're getting. How do you have one? You mentioned the employers. Is that the most important persona, or how do you balance?
You know, I created in that same slide deck, I created like a bar chart of, all right, here's how many features we built that were specific for each type. And then I adjusted that bar chart over 2017 each quarter to show the focus. We spent a lot of 16 and 17, as you know, getting kind of to market parity. How do we kind of get to this place that our clients expect us to be at, that the market expects us to be at, maybe that some of our competitors might be at, so a little bit competitor focused, so that we can then think, after we get through 17, we can then layer in more innovation. And then I did the same kind of graph for how much work was client-based work in 17 and into 18, and how much became innovation and thought leadership, market kind of leadership through 17 and through 18. And we would also see the graph of getting to market parity versus innovation, those lines crossing and moving in the direction that we want, which is to be leading the market in terms of the types of things that we produce for employers.
You're saying you are trying to get to market parity, and that the way that you defined that was what customers are expecting and what your competition is doing. And once you get that baseline on the parity, then that's when you can prioritize innovative, more innovative offerings or kind of...
Yeah, and it also means that, you know, again, Pareto rule, 80-20. I mean, we want to get that 80 or that 90%. And then what's the effort to value scale of that last 10%? So can we spend another 6 months just to eke out a few more percent? And will that matter to our clients?
How do you balance... I'll steal Anna's thunder here, but you seem very knowledgeable on what your customers want. So what does that feedback mechanism look like for you? How do you handle that? You had a lot of data when you came in to start, but over the last 2 years, as you're informing your roadmap, what is your role or your team's role in engaging with customers or even maybe potential prospects?
Multifold strategy. And one of my main goals was actually to arm all client-facing reps that we have. So if you're in sales, if you're in client success, and I would call them, make them like mini CIA agents that were working for product, and let them know the right questions to ask and to ask why 6 times. Not that they want this feature, but why do you want this feature? What problem are you trying to solve? Why are you trying to solve that problem? And the deeper that they would go, we basically created a product army without having...
You know, sorry, what roles were those that you were...
These were client success.
Okay.
These were sales. And actually some of what I told them was, I'm not going to build this new feature until you ask these 5 questions. So I think it created a culture of everyone thinking more product oriented and problem oriented. What are those problems that we're trying to solve? We want them to ask a set of questions always when a customer requests a feature. Otherwise, you can end up, and I know a lot of our colleagues in scale up startups around town, they just hear, you should build this, you should build this. And we as product people always have to ask why, what's the job to be done, and what problem are you ultimately trying to get at? Otherwise, you're either going to Frankenstein build a product, or you're going to build the wrong features, and it won't go well.
How did that help you?
They were coming back with a lot of great information about how the different personas, you know, what problems they were trying to solve, how they were using the app, how frequently they were using the app, kind of answer the larger question of how do we get the information. Sure, user voice was a little bit, we made this army of great intelligence of people coming back to us with actually really good ideas rather than just a whole bunch of noise. And actually it became so good that I asked the client success lead and the head of sales to actually funnel all the ideas through them, because there were actually so many good ideas. And then we had to start prioritizing those ideas. So I would say at that point, even in 17, we were still a sales led roadmap kind of organization because we were still catching up, but we were getting great input. So we matched that input with as much data analytics and usage as we could, with user voice, with our own expertise, to pair together what, you know, our product philosophy was and what, you know, we believed the market needed in that year.
What's a product philosophy?
Product philosophy is probably a larger perspective of what is your strategy for the year? What clients are you obtaining today? What partners are you bringing on? Where do you want to be? And then how do you skate where the puck is heading in terms of your product towards that? It's a living thing. It's not a science. I mean, it's as much as we try to create processes around it, I think it's mostly an art of, I think a good product person has just a good spidey sense. You just know that you are getting a product market fit. You know when you are out on the front. Like, I spend a lot of time pitching to prospective clients with our salespeople because I want to stay sharp. It's not just our current clients who are requesting things. And every chance I get in those sales meetings, I'm pitching ideas. I'm pitching something that we're thinking of, and I've had ideas pitched, like a real-time communication idea. I thought that might be a good strategy for us. I even presented it to the company that communication is a pillar of what we might do. And as I pitched it more and more and more after I presented to the company, people said, yeah, this is really cool. I think I would use it. I don't think that's strong enough. I don't think that's a strong enough conviction to know to build something, to invest 6 months of six engineers to build something. So as close as you can get to knowing that you should build that thing, I think there's just an art to all of the techniques of arming your client team, getting usage and user data, doing client surveys, and then being out on the sales front and just talking to people. Sure, you can go to a conference, you can bring user groups together, which is great, but the best people for you are usually the ones who haven't bought your product yet and who have their own idea about the market, and then you can consolidate the best of breed from that sales.
So you're saying that you would go into sales meetings and you would pitch ideas?
Yeah, so probably shamelessly. Yeah. I would come in there and I was brought in to talk about roadmap and the future, and I would do that. And then I'd go, well, since I have you all here, here's something we're thinking about. Like, is this something you'd use? How would you use it? And I would kind of interrogate that for 5, 10, 15 minutes. And people love to talk about it. They love to talk about where the industry's heading. And like, if we built this, how would you use it? Would you use it? How frequently would you use it? And so I think we always try to sneak in those questions, because sometimes with a salesperson, there's just a different level of trust when you're in a sales meeting. You have a salesperson, they bring in the product person. It's like, oh, this product person's not going to lie to us. They're friendly. They're telling us exactly what's going on, versus a salesperson presenting roadmap. Is it really going to happen? You don't know if it will come true.
A lot of sales teams might not be as comfortable with what you're describing. And I think that, you know, they might feel as if pitching too much of a future vision that you can't deliver on might make, you know, create some anxiety. So I'm curious how you've handled that and with success.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. So again, I think when I came into the company in 16, you know, as I mentioned about that list of 23 items, we had a lot of outstanding commitments because things were pitched. So back to the product philosophy too, what we show, usually we have a pretty good confidence level that this will be done next sprint, next month, next quarter, or within 6 months. And I think there's a Mick Ebling wrote a book, and one of I heard him talk as well. Great. He said, commit, then figure it out. And I think there's a time and a place where you actually should take the leap and go, you know what? I'm not sure how we would do it or if we're going to do it, but we've talked about it. We should commit to this in a contract, and it's a good thing for our business. And yes, engineering might get, you know, a little crazed because we committed to something big and we weren't quite sure, but you have to take some of those leaps, I think, to get to greatness. But then you have to pair that with a more systematic process that you work with your engineering teams. You let them be autonomous to say, here's what we can actually do by next quarter. And we're implementing some of these processes now that I presented our leadership meetings of what our engineering team said we can do by the end of March is this, rather than from the top down saying, by the end of March, we're going to do XYZ. And so I think it's a cultural shift too, but not going too far out in those sales meetings to kind of share what we have high levels of confidence that we are going to achieve.
So when you said 2017 was still sort of sales-led, what did you mean by that?
I think it was still kind of that market parity. It was still getting up to speed. What are our competitors doing that we're not? Where does the market expect us to be? What's some of the features and functionality that we can't do or that we feel is the future? Knowing that our industry moves slow and we're like, you know, hey, we don't want any more paper reports. You remember this? This is like a big charge. No more paper reports. But the world still runs on these paper reports, and brokers will still come to meetings with, you know, here's how you're doing. And it's not like you come with your laptop and you put it, you AirPlay it up on the TV, and you're like, here's kind of how we're looking as a, and here's the things that we did, and here's how much we saved. It's still kind of these reports. So it's hard as an organization who's really progressive, who wants to disrupt the industry, to say, well, we know we have to serve this progressive piece, and this is where our vision is, this is where our mission is, to take a step backwards to make sure that we're serving the rest of the more traditional world.
How do you balance that, pushing people to think differently, but also serving like existing needs?
Well, human behavior is a hard thing to change. There's areas where you can change it. There's areas where you can't change it. So I think when we build product, again, that product philosophy piece, we try to build things that are progressive, knowing that we can hold hands along the way, and that we believe through usage, just through simplicity, through just pure efficiency, you can go down this route, or you can do it a lot easier way.
So as you shift from sales-led to product-led, end of 2017, going into 2018, let's dive into that a little bit. So what does that mean to you?
I mean, a lot of strategy sessions with the product team, consulting all of the leaders with all the divisions, a lot of one-on-ones, testing out ideas. It was a really cool moment, because I think we acknowledged that we had what we needed to sell the product today. So if we built nothing new, we felt like we could go capture X percent of the market just with this. And that's a great feeling, but it's a scary feeling. It's a scary feeling because now you realize you're in charge of what is the next great thing. Are people interested in that great thing? And back to that communication idea I had, that was one of the potential next great things. And as we did more testing and we were out in the field there, we found out it wasn't. However, one of the three pillars we had like communication, connectedness, and insights kind of was another area. So we actually ended up probably doing one of those three, and one of those three led to one of the biggest second product launches in the history outside of the core product called Insights.
So before we dive into Insights, what told you those other were not? So communication, you thought pretty strongly that was the way to go. You got out into the field. What was the moment? How did you determine that this was not worth it?
You don't build cool ideas. You build really cool ideas that also meet direct market needs or solve problems that your customers didn't know existed, or are very direct problems that your customers are saying existed. And I feel like we would have built a solution for a problem that was sort of there and people weren't excited enough.
So you already decided to do a new product. You have that commitment that Insights is going to be it. When you start building it, did you know at that time what your strategy was for rolling it out? Did you know that we're going to do it for this one customer?
I think we were already building it, and then the customer came along and it was a big customer, and we had an opportunity to win the deal by stretching. And I think we had a level of confidence with our team that we could do it, and we stretched to do it.
So the stretch goal to win a client was effectively what became this new feature.
We said, who's interested? And kind of kept it, you know, keep some shroud of secrecy, some excitement around it. So you had to be invited, you know, but we would offer it to our clients.
I love those. So fun.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, we had like 180 different users using it. We were tracking how frequently they were using it. We were tracking which insights they use. We were tracking which areas they clicked on in the card.
Why in February 2018 did you not just roll out this insights feature to everybody? Why did you gate it behind a beta?
So I think if you're in a beta and you're soliciting feedback and you're soliciting it from a smaller group of friendlies and people you trust who are experts, you get to operate on your speed and people understand it's a beta. And they understand things are going to change and they might not work. You build a new product. How many bugs are you going to find? What's not going to work? You open up the floodgates immediately. You run the risk of, hey, we're there quicker. We're there faster. Maybe we can sell quicker. But you can create a huge strain on your engineering product team.
So you're giving it away for free during the beta period. At some point, and you're talking about how to price it. Once the beta period is over, how did you communicate the pricing to the people that were using it? Were you talking to them throughout that period? Or was it just sort of like, okay, it's over, here it is?
Tricky. So some customers probably got the sense that it was just included. So we had to deal with the, you're already paying for this, and then really show them the value, even though they were using it. And well, I thought you said this was part of the package. So, you know, we grandfathered in some people. You target also renewal time, saying like, look, this is a new product, there's a price tag associated with it. You're going to get it for free for this period of time. We'll talk about it again at renewal. And then hopefully you can't live without it. It's a part of your workflow. And then a lot of just pricing exercise and science.
Would you have done anything differently as you rolled out this product?
I'm so proud of how we did it. It's one of my favorite achievements of my career.
Varying opinions on whether it's best to be first to market or best in market. So what are your thoughts about that?
I think there's no right answer. And I think it's situational. And it depends on the market that you're in. You look at the Silicon Valley wars, the things that happen on the West Coast with all the tech companies. A lot of it is just getting first to market, getting the marketing machine going, and we're doing this thing. We're innovating. We're releasing this open source thing. So there's a place for it in marketing. There's a place for it in sales and salesmanship to say we're the only ones doing this. And that's like a big thing of mine too. I love saying we're the only ones in the world doing this. And that's a great sales piece. That's also an inspirational piece for everyone who works for you, right? We're the only ones in the world doing this. We're the first people doing this. But there's a lot of cases, I think, where that's not necessarily the best thing to do. You always want to be first to market. And again, look back at many examples of things that were first to market, best to market. iPod wasn't the first thing to market. The Zune was. iPod won. Zune lost.
Friendster.
Right. Yeah. Facebook wasn't the first thing there. So I think it's hard to look at it, but sometimes, and depending on your industry, you can create groundswell and you can create a brand and people just know that thing.
What does better product mean to you?
It's the value of, if you look at an X and Y axis of what is the value of what you're creating and what is the effort to create that thing and how much have you already met of what you feel is the problem.
That was Jeremy Leventhal, Chief Product Officer at Springbuck. You can check out what he and his team are up to at springbuck.com.
So this is the part of the show where we bring in someone from Innovate Map to get their thoughts on. And for this episode, we really want to bring in Lacey Labies, our resident product management expert. So just to start, let's talk about customer feedback. So this is something that he talked about a lot. He's very customer informed. He's going on sales calls. He's getting feedback from customers. How do you coach entrepreneurs, product managers, anybody who has to deal with customers? How do you coach them on how to deal with product feedback?
Feedback is something I am deeply passionate about because I think people handle it incorrectly a lot of the time. So it's really easy, especially when you're in the startup phase, to respond to any request that people are asking of you because you want to make them happy. But I think what's really important is to understand kind of the general applicability of some of the feedback that you're receiving. So that means, how is this going to impact the other 100 customers that I'm going to have in 3 months, 6 months?
What if you don't have many customers?
You don't always have to go around asking people. I think that's a mistake that people make too. They hear feedback, they want to validate it, so they just go ask their other 4 customers if this, makes sense or if they have this problem. And I think you have to approach it from a little bit of a higher level rather than asking them direct questions. You have to try to get at the pain that they're experiencing.
Give me an example of a customer feedback and how you would kind of get at the actual what's going on there.
So you have to validate it for general applicability. I think that's step one. And there's various ways of going about that. For sure, you could talk to other customers, but like I said, you don't want to basically ask them, are you having this problem, repeating what the other person said, but rather asking them questions about that area of the product, how they're using it, what's frustrating to them today about it, rather than asking them a leading question that could lead you to bad feedback.
Jeremy talked a little bit about his spidey sense, about how he, when he's talking to customers or in sales meetings or whatever, he gets this sense for what would be a good feature or he knows, he can tell what they're asking for. How do you think that your expertise helps you determine that's a customer feedback to act on or that's not a good idea?
In the early days, you want to please people. You want to make your customers happy. So a lot of times you're just acting on feedback. You're hearing what the market's saying and you're reacting to it. I think that's where a lot of product managers kind of get stuck in that world where they are just continually reacting to customer feedback. There's a saying, and I don't know who to attribute it to, but they say that most of your users will use about 20% of your product. So all of the other 80%, like a lot of times, it's just ticky-tacky things that people have asked for that you think matter at the time. But when you step back and you start to think about the key workflows of a certain user, of your target user, maybe it's your sweet spot for your software, a certain type of user, a certain type of customer of yours that is just like a great fit, and they go through a specific workflow and you really want to master and perfect that workflow. I think that makes a lot of sense versus reacting to feedback that might be on a feature that doesn't get a lot of usage. That's another point to think about, the impact, what percentage of your users are going to be impacted by a change as well.
One thing you said too that I reminded me of something Jeremy said was you're talking about product managers getting stuck during the ticky-tack details or just being reactive. And Jeremy mentioned talking about, you know, how to push things forward, like how to do, you know, new features cool new features that were also driven by the market. So I feel like up until this point, we've talked a lot about like how you handle like customer feedback, but then there's that next challenge of, because you could easily just take that and just keep churning through that and there's nothing spectacular. But how do you then take handling that side of product management within like, okay, your role is also to create something cool that's market driven. How does a product manager handle the day-to-day tactical improvements to a product with the forward-looking next generation market leading features?
One helpful perspective to have on that is that you have to carve out time for the new. Otherwise, you will be consumed by what people are asking for. It will take over and keep you busy for a long time. And you'll make your current customers very happy, but you won't necessarily be securing the number of new customers that you're looking for. So I think first step is carving out the time. The second part that feels very simple to me, but that people don't always do, is like continuous communication with your customers and understanding kind of their life outside of what your product is currently solving for them will open up opportunities, identify pains that you didn't even know they had because you weren't asking about them because your current product doesn't address them. But really getting to know your target users day to day. What are they using other workarounds for or other tools for that you could maybe insert a step into the process? I think looking at analogous industries is another thing that we tend to do a lot of here. There's a lot of innovation that is happening in other industries that could very well be applicable to what you're doing.
What is that? So yeah, tell us the analogous part. So analogous industries. So for what does that mean?
So a lot of times in SaaS software, kind of any other SaaS software could be in an analogous industry. I know a lot of people today are really hot on Slack and Airbnb and Uber, and these are just the examples that we all look to because we have a great experience with these applications. So there's a lot that they do and how they onboard their customers, the self-service aspect of their products, how easy it is to use. You don't need training, ongoing customer engagement. Like all of these things, well, maybe you wouldn't think about them as product features, could very well be very impactful to your success.
I want to recap what you just said, because I think it's really important. So you, in order to kind of help product managers or as a product manager to kind of go beyond the day-to-day feature request, so carve out time for it, number one. So that means time in your day, time, space in your roadmap, dedicated to new and different things. You also mentioned to understand your customers outside of your product. So where are the potential workarounds? Where are the pains that maybe if you were just asking at the product, you wouldn't see, you wouldn't hear, you wouldn't be aware of. And then the final thing you mentioned was analogous industries. So looking at other types of software or other products out there that may not be direct competitors, may not play in your space, but have potentially applicable patterns that you could use, copy, or leverage. Thanks so much for listening to the show this week. If you haven't yet, be sure to subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. Until then, visit innovatemap.com/podcast and subscribe to learn how you can take your product to the next level. As always, we're curious, what does better product mean to you? Hit us up on Twitter at InnovateMap or shoot us an email at podcast@innovatemap.com.
I'm Christian.
And I'm Anna. And you've been listening to Better Product.
Better Product.
Drop mic.